Energy Singularity, the Event Horizon Podcast, a podcast where energy blockchain visionaries discuss the future of energy. Join me, Kevin O'Donovan, as I chat with some of the world's leading visionaries to take a realistic view as to what's really going on. In the past two episodes, we've heard from Maria McCavanagh at Verve and Dave Martin from Power Ledger, and what they see out there today as they build their businesses in the energy industry, and how they see blockchain as an enabling technology for their solutions. And we wanted to hear from such visionaries as, given the dose of realism we've been dishing out so far, some people might be starting to wonder if there was any future for blockchain in the energy industry. There certainly is. And for episode 7, I'd like to welcome Jojo Hubbard, co-founder and CEO of Electron. Welcome, Jojo.
Thanks very much, Kevin. It's great to be speaking again.
Jojo, for people who may not know you, can you do a quick introduction?
So I co-founded Electron just over 3 years ago with my co-founder, Paul Ellis. My background is, I've spent 10 odd years in the distributed energy space, but I started on the finance side. So I spent my first 4 odd years on the investment banking side. We were essentially funding or channeling money into a lot of these big kind of early stage kind of grid scale technologies. So we did some of the first big offshore wind financings. We did some large solar portfolios. Then I graduated into the, still on the investment side, but more the kind of batteries or smart grid tech side. You know, I always say, once you've done, you know, 2 wind farms, you've done them all. But I was interested in how do you solve this problem that was kind of increasingly being created of things like curtailment. So too much wind power and we're actually cutting off the system. Or this need to balance the grid and paying all these large old coal plants to stay alive just to kind of be on beck and call for when there's no renewables. So obviously batteries and smart grid tech became really exciting. We identified all these different channels and ways they could make money. And they were going to sell balancing services to the grid operator, locational or constraint relief services to the network operator, energy to communities or to suppliers to balance their trading positions. And we found that there wasn't a route to market for all of these different value components. So we left that fund idea aside. I went to join McKinsey to do a lot of work on digital transformation. I spent quite a lot of time thinking around this problem, and we decided it was fundamentally a coordination problem. So essentially an asset can't play in multiple markets at the same time, because not everyone was calling it by the same name. Parties weren't able to let each other know that they were doing this with that asset and there was this value component still going, or this thing was going to come for free. So we started massively looking at this challenge of how to coordinate data sets and markets. And someone pointed me to the Ethereum white paper, and I got very excited. And I met my co-founder at the time, who was coming in from the fintech side, where he'd be building electronic trading platforms for 20 plus years. And together we came up with this idea of a distributed asset register that connected to multiple types of trading platform and multiple types of trades.
And what are you up to at Electron?
So we are essentially designing a large coordination platform. Conceptually, it's got kind of 2 components. So there's the asset registration component that endows a single asset with a single identity and allows that asset to be associated with who owns it, who operates it, and the contractual relationships it's entered into. And then it's kind of metadata or essentially the attributes of that asset. We are doing a large project there with 3 utilities, National Grid, UK Power Networks, and Scottish Power Energy Networks, essentially to coordinate this thing they call the Week 24 Asset Register, which is a shared register of all assets down to 1 megawatt that they have to update each other on essentially every year. That's really never up to date because it spends so long being updated and reconciled. So it's creating that in a living, breathing form. It's creating a single version of the truth without having kind of one single arbiter of the truth as to kind of what's out there in the network, what can it do and what is it doing now. Then conceptually, the other part of that are the kind of different types of trading platforms that link to it. So each type of trade might have a different trading protocol, for example, but there are some trades that are things like balancing kind of supply and demand across the whole system. There are some trades that are doing things like trading curtailments or constraint relief. So let's say you don't have enough network to export all of the power that's coming onto the system. Can one clean generator pay a dirty generator with a higher operating cost to take its right to export? or alternatively, can a clean generator pay a end user to use more power in that period so that they don't get constrained off the network? And those are two examples of the many types of examples of trading platforms that can hang off this shared asset register. So conceptually, we're not going to be the only people building some of these traded markets, but we're going to build some of these traded markets because it reinforces the requirement or the desire for parties to go and actively register their assets on the asset registration platform and kind of become part of this broader ecosystem of connected energy assets that are being kind of optimized across a larger area.
Now, during the course of this series, the more I find out what companies like yours are up to, the more it becomes clear that fundamentally, it's all about enabling the creation of energy markets, like you just called out. However, due to a lot of the hype related to blockchain in the past few years, we often oversimplified a lot of this, and we use sweeping terms like energy communities and peer-to-peer. I use them a lot. It got called out as a big elephant in the room back in episode 4 by Anna. Many people are not 100% sure what's meant by peer-to-peer or meant by an energy community. Or each of us has our own definition. And my definition is completely different to the definition of the person sitting on the other side of the table. So what's your take on this elephant in the room?
I think actually we as an industry are missing something in terms of definitions. So when people say energy community, they can mean a lot of different things. They can mean communities of people who live in a similar area and can all use power from one local energy, clean energy source, for example. Or they could have more of the Sonnen type energy community in mind, which is more of a kind of a financial netting arrangement type community. And actually, strangely, I've noticed in the past, particularly on this series, people kind of jump to peer-to-peer energy trading being more of that kind of almost like accounting layer. The energy community, particularly that we're working on, is much more of a kind of physics-based solution. So we are exploring a number of areas where there is insufficient network capacity at times to export all of the clean power coming on the system. And actually one particular region has 120% renewable penetration. So there's also insufficient demand. But then at other times there is not enough power supply or sun or wind essentially to meet all of the demand. So you've actually got this kind of two-sided market. And what we're looking to do is essentially allow some of the renewable projects that are set to be curtailed or essentially cut off from being able to export their power because there is too much clean power on the system, to pay end users to turn up and essentially use more power in that period. So essentially then that generation no longer gets curtailed by the active network management system in place, and you get more essentially cleaner, greener power on the system. That's the kind of like energy community, quote unquote, that I'm really excited about, because it's only when you are able to affect power flows that you can actually move to this kind of promise that we were first given with the kind of whole renewable revolution of kind of cleaner, greener, more resilient power systems. It's only when you can deploy the power more effectively, essentially, rather than just kind of run an accounting layer post-fact, that you're going to use the assets that we already have more efficiently.
That does make a lot of sense. As you say, the goal here is to actually impact how we generate, store, dispatch, and consume energy. It's not about having a cool technology to simply do the accounting. It's been brought up time and time again by folks on the series. We have to tie all this back to the physical grid.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the other problem I have with kind of peer-to-peer that doesn't take into account physics and is just a financial layer is this idea that, let's say, in a world where you have high solar penetration, maybe kind of 50% of the houses have solar, and you probably don't need to go anywhere near that high, it's probably something more like 20 or 30%, then everyone is going to have power at the same time. And that's exactly the sort of time when you might get grid constraints. So, you know, selling that power to someone who is behind a grid constraint, behind an export constraint, you can't actually get the power to, is not helpful. It's not doing what we said we were going to do with renewables, which is essentially all of this flexibility, is essentially use existing assets more effectively. You might even have negative power prices, and yet someone's paying a positive price for them. And all of that has to come back on someone. So I'm not anti-peer-to-peer in any way. I think peer-to-peer is incredibly exciting. And as a startup in this space, if your only counterparts are, you know, system operators and network operators, then that's a really tough, long gig. So we've spent a lot of time trying to work out how we can bring peers and companies and asset owners into this market, where you can pay someone to use more power in a particular period to avoid being curtailed yourself, actually does bring more value to, let's say, the solar plant owner, because they are now getting paid to export as opposed to getting paid nothing because they've been curtailed. It brings more value to the person with an electric heating system because they're now able to heat their house for less money. And it brings more value to the grid or kind of society in general because you have more clean power on board. But those are hard use cases because you have to work with the existing network operators to deploy them. But once you've got them deployed, your counterparts are those peers. They are those energy users and those asset operators in that region. And for me, that's what gets me really excited. That's the way in, if you would, for the kind of peer-to-peer, quote-unquote, in its kind of broader sense of the meaning.
It is hard. Having worked on a number of such projects in the past few years, you really have to work with a lot of different parties to pull it all together. But it is doable. Now, however, one feature I'll call out. If I'm a consumer out there listening to all this, it sounds really complicated. And they might be thinking that they'll need a degree in energy market design to be able to participate in all this. So how do you explain to a consumer how all this works for them? You know, will the consumer need to spend a lot of time trying to figure all this out? When's the best time for them to use electricity? Or will all this be automated?
Ultimately, it's automated. I mean, you know, you have better things to be doing at 2 a.m. in the morning than waiting for the price signal to heat your house now. But probably, you know, your electrical heating system doesn't have much else going on and it's perfectly willing to watch the market and respond to those price signals. And there's a whole bunch of suppliers and aggregators who are essentially, or even device manufacturers, who are essentially building in those aggregation platforms. And ultimately, there's going to be a whole bunch of kind of almost like white labeled set and forget type devices or services people can sign up to for that to happen.
It was way back in episode one when Marzia and Scott called out that the complexity on how these energy markets actually work has to be under the covers. All the consumer wants is to have an energy service that brings them value, the value they want. But let me play devil's advocate for a minute. Making this energy transition real is really hard. The technologies to enable it themselves are complicated, yet technology is still the easy bit compared to the energy policy, the regulations, the business models, and consumer acceptance. Now, our main focus in the series has been on the role of blockchain technology and what role it can play in all this, especially as the technology matures. Now, Jojo, you're out there today. So is the energy industry transitioning? You know, is it getting easier? Is change happening? Is the culture changing? What's going on?
There is a kind of completely new way of doing things welling up, but it's sort of being forced on utilities by the renewables that are already in the ground, let alone the ones that are coming. So, you know, UK has been running coal-free. It's broken two kind of coal-free records and had coal-free weeks and everything recently. And so the system operator here, National Grids, had to manage and balance that. And they've then come out saying, well, you know, this is something we're perfectly capable of doing for the whole system. Give us a couple of years, you know. So that change in many ways is coming anyway on the electricity side, in my view. And then I was at a conference last week and I was kind of saying, you know, we already know how to decarbonize the electricity sector. Let's look at, you know, heat and transport and all these things. And people kind of looking at me as kind of like I was insane, like, yeah, we might have the technology to do it, but actually we're not there yet. So it does get quite easy to kind of live in your echo chamber and think we already know how to do this, so we're doing it. What I have seen massively change really in the last, certainly in the last 10 years of working with utilities, but definitely in the last 5 years, is the culture towards innovation. They've got these astounding new innovation teams in place with some of the kind of smartest people in the sector in it. But what we're still seeing is some of those innovation teams are innovation teams. They're not in every single department. They're a sort of separate team. And as some of these kind of proof point projects are deployed, and we're going to see that increasingly happening over the next 12 to 24 months, as more and more of these proof points are deployed, I think you'll start seeing those innovation kind of people in all departments. And, you know, it'll be a kind of cross-cutting function as opposed to its kind of own new departments. So there's definitely a culture change in utilities in terms of that. I think in terms of the culture change for this whole sector in general, the kind of innovators and the kind of more traditional utilities, as well as the regulators and the government, I mean, this is an astoundingly collaborative industry. We are all sitting at the table with one another, similar people, probably two or three times a week. You know, trying to make it two or three times a month because, you know, everyone's time is limited, but really, really talking about these problems together. Everyone knows everyone else's amazing kind of camaraderie. You know, at the end of the day, we all want this transition to be a success and to come faster. So I think the culture is already well in the ways of changing. I think some of the ways that startups and tech innovators can change it faster is learning how to speak the language of regulation and the languages of physics and speaking to people in their own language and talking to them about how to make something work instead of telling them what the answer already is and kind of hoping they can retrofit it. And I think, as you say, as this blockchain industry has matured as well, there are increasingly more players who are able to do that. So I'm confident and excited that the pace is picking up. But remember, like, again, this isn't just blockchain. Like, there's a lot of solutions that we're looking at that need, for example, active network management kit to be deployed, or network monitoring, or any of these other kind of physical things too. You know, devices that shut off generators according to dispatch signals. So there is also that kind of phase of all these different types of people, hardware manufacturers, software manufacturers, trading platform designers, network operators, genuinely having to work together to make this happen.
In most of the episodes so far, energy regulation pops up. And you mentioned a few minutes ago how this energy industry is an astoundingly collaborative industry. So we have to work with the regulators to get their buy-in so that regulations get changed. And ideally, it all gets done sooner rather than later. Now, at Electron, you've been involved a lot with the UK regulator and their sandbox, right?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, we were one of the first projects in Ofgem's sandbox. So that's the UK energy regulator who created the first regulatory sandbox for energy. We treat the regulator and government as massive, very, very important stakeholders to us. Actually, none of the use cases we're working on require regulatory change. And I think it's a shame how so much of the discussion of blockchain has kind of got stuck on, or regulation doesn't allow peer-to-peer, because they've assumed that peer-to-peer is, I don't have solar, my neighbor has solar, my neighbor should be able to give me their solar, but I don't own the wires that connect us. I think that is sort of missing a lot of really important points that regulators are tasked with dealing, which is, well, who pays for the pipes and wires, and how are those costs recovered, and how should those costs be distributed equitably? So obviously, if that kind of first version of kind of get power from your neighbor peer-to-peer scale, then a whole bunch of people who couldn't afford solar panels or couldn't afford their own networks would be left holding the burden for paying for the entire kind of network, which would be an extraordinary shame and very short-sighted kind of market design. But the regulators are working on how you can allow people to get more value from their power or get more equity from their solar if they're able to supply parties locally, given they're not using so much the grid, without putting too much of the burden on those parties who aren't able to play in this market. And I think that regulators, in a way, aren't given enough credit. I mean, particularly in the UK, we have incredibly proactive regulators who've been looking at this problem from every single angle and taking a lot of stakeholder input. There are some broader regulatory or kind of market design issues that are sort of hangovers. And I think one of the ones mentioned in your last episode was this idea that utilities get paid for all the assets they put in the ground. So, you know, how on earth do you incentivize someone to do less of the thing they get paid for and put fewer wires in the ground and go for non-wires alternatives on using existing assets more effectively, especially given that they're not now the owner of all of these kind of existing assets. Those are really interesting regulatory problems. I actually sit on one of the challenge groups, me personally, not me as Electron, in the UK for this next kind of five-year phase of design, of market design for how networks get paid. And one of the topics that that group is incredibly focused on, and all of this came out in the press last week, is essentially making more efficient use of existing assets and not paying parties to kind of go and gold plate what we already have in the ground, especially if we don't need to put any new wires in the ground when we can use behind the meter assets more effectively and consumers benefit from that.
So let me play devil's advocate again, Jojo. As good as the work the regulators do, one of the elephants in the room that keeps getting called out is that regulators are still too slow, too set in their ways. They're afraid to change anything. Are we being a bit too hard on the regulators?
Firstly, I should probably, on the regulators' behalf, I find myself speaking for regulators a lot because I've been really impressed by them over this whole process. But essentially, I wouldn't characterize it as afraid to do it. Essentially, they make evidence-based decisions. So it's working with the regulator to build up a body of evidence as to why this or that rule is no longer fit for purpose and how consumers would be particularly benefited if this rule or this code was changed. So what we were looking at there, for example, was can you have more than one supplier for a meter point? Can you, for example, get power from your community solar array while it's generating and then get backup power from your supplier when it's not? And I think that whole process is really, really positive. I mean, it's actually opened up a very different level of dialogue between all these different parties who need to be around the table, like suppliers, like regulators, and startups and hardware manufacturers and all those people.
Okay, back to blockchain. Jojo, when we met up at DistribuTech at the start of the year, you were very optimistic about the role blockchain can play in this industry, yet you're very pragmatic about when and where to use the technology.
Absolutely. We are very pragmatic. So blockchain is a very good technology where you have multiple parties who need to coordinate, who essentially their sort of overall interest is met or aligned in coordinating, but they are potentially competitive or they potentially want different things at a different time. And it's not a good technology yet for many other uses. For example, I mean, I think storing 5-minute by 5-minute meter data on blockchain and distributing that would be very expensive and actually somewhat pointless. So we have very much gone after the solutions that require coordination, but we've been very, very careful not to kind of put everything on blockchain. So for example, for our asset register, the kind of unique ID is on blockchain, the references to where data is stored off-chain is on-chain, and essentially you can grant or rescind access permissions on-chain. But we don't actually have all of that data sitting on-chain, and that helps in various other things like protecting data privacy and what have you. Then on the trading platform side, there are certain trades that need to be collaborative. So our long-time vision is a lot more of energy trading, particularly around flexibility, move to kind of more liquid, nearer real-time markets. And in those near real-time markets where you know you're trading active power, there are all sorts of things that you can trade collaboratively, like the battery example I gave, like balancing plus constraint relief plus power supply or financial position. Whereas there are other markets that we're trading that don't need to be on-chain yet. So, for example, single buyer marketplaces. Let's say it's a single distribution network operator buying services from a bunch of people in an area, they then do become that natural central authority. So you may still want to refer to the distributed asset register to kind of notify other parties what you're doing. But for the kind of long-term in advance trades, it's not necessary to put that on chain yet. So I think what I was trying to say is don't put everything on blockchain just because blockchain's cool. But it's a very, very interesting technology for solving and discussing this ginormous coordination challenge that's hit the industry since the rollout of all of these clean distributed assets.
As we're coming to the end of the podcast, is there anything we've not mentioned yet?
I guess the only other thing that's been coming up so far is a lot of people talking about how immature the technology is. And I mean, in the same way that maybe kind of 25 years ago, relational databases were kind of opening up huge opportunities for companies to kind of share and access their data in a different way. But I don't think the companies were standing around going, this is really immature, I'm not going to do anything with it. I think they were able to already start implementing more kind of basic applications. So an example of a basic application in the blockchain space would be this idea of the kind of shared identity register and deploy it. It's definitely true that the technology is kind of moving and coming along very fast. And that means people will be able to do increasingly complex things and store increasingly large amounts of data on here. But I really don't think that there are no useful blockchain applications that can be implemented today that don't bring value to an industry that's massively struggling with a coordination and identification challenge.
Yeah, good points. I've actually been getting a bit of heat online from folks saying I'm a bit too hard on poor old blockchain. Now, hopefully in the past few episodes, we've been getting across that while blockchain is a relatively new technology, it really does have a role to play today. Well, thanks a lot, Jojo. It's been great to chat with you again, and I'll see you in Berlin.
Thank you. It's been such fun, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Energy Singularity. Please do give us a review, subscribe to receive future episodes, and please do join the conversation and share your own thoughts with us via social media. You can find details on all our social media accounts in the show notes. And be sure to visit the event site, eventhorizonsummit.com, to find out all the latest and greatest about the upcoming event. And I hope to see you all at the Event Horizon Summit this June in Berlin.